Full Service Radio is supported by Compass, the future of real estate in the Metro DC area and beyond. Discover more at compass.com.
You're tuned into Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Welcome to Lunch Agenda on Full Service Radio at the Line Hotel in DC. I'm your host, Kiko Bourne. My job is to bring undercovered parts of the food system straight to you every week and provide you with specific ways you can become a food activist in your day-to-day life. Today, we're continuing the series I'm calling Food Admin, where we illuminate a handful of the jobs that are often overlooked or undervalued in our food system, but without which food organizations like restaurants, farms, and food banks would not be able to do what they do. If you're a listener pondering where you might fit into a food organization, this is the series for you. I kicked it off in conversation with a food accountant who helps his restaurant clients navigate the right compromises to make their businesses sustain. Then last week, I was reunited with two dynamic administrative assistants I worked with at the Capital Area Food Bank who talked about the gratification they get from building team morale, an especially crucial job in food nonprofits where resources can be an ongoing challenge. Today, we'll dive deeper into the people side in conversation about food human resources, or HR as I will call it throughout the show. An article published last December on Vice's food site Munchies said of HR, quote, "In many restaurants in this industry, big and small, there is no one in this role. There's a simple enough reason. Restaurant margins are razor thin, and HR isn't seen as contributing to the bottom line," end quote. Today, I have that article's author, Leah Campbell, a New York restaurant owner and HR leader, with us. I also have a local HR director, Claire Parker of Neighborhood Restaurant Group, in the studio with me. So we'll be talking about why HR does contribute to the bottom line and contributes to other aspects of a food business's sustainability. But first, let's get things going with some Kiko's food news. Major dining franchises like TGI Fridays and Applebee's are struggling financially, and some, like Friendly's and Bennigan's, have filed for bankruptcy. This coincides with changing dining habits in this country. The upper class has soured on paying $20 for a meal of bland bar fare, and the chain-sustaining middle class can no longer afford it. That, coupled with a widening breadth of delivery options through third-party services like Seamless and Uber Eats, makes the future of casual dining chains unclear. I read a New York Times article about Red Lobster's attempt to stay relevant by announcing a lobster and waffles special to appeal to the latest trends. It's worth checking out, TBD, whether that tactic worked for the chain. In other restaurant news, a growing number of chains are going cashless. From Chicago-based Epic Burger to DC Export Sweetgreen and New York City's Daily Provisions by Danny Meyer. Some argue that going cashless prevents a sizable swath of the population who can't obtain a credit or debit card from making purchases. And as for Danny Meyer, is it strange for the guy who wrote the book on hospitality to not accept the most egalitarian system of payment? So there are mixed feelings on that topic, convenience versus access. And in hopeful news for today, have you heard about the latest solution to the problem of straws in America? Final Straw is a reusable straw that folds up and lives on your keychain. And the makers say one Final Straw purchase can save 584 straws from going into landfills or oceans each year. This matters given that plastic straws can't be recycled and are so lightweight that they often fly out of garbage piles and into waterways where they can harm wildlife. Final Straw's taking pre-orders with their Kickstarter, which has raised almost $2 million thus far, so you can find that online if you want to pre-order one for yourself. We're going to take a break, and when I come back, I will be very excited to introduce Claire and Leah to teach us about the work they do in food human resources. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
Service Radio is supported by Compass. Discover Compass, America's first modern real estate company. By pairing the industry's top agents with technology, Compass delivers an incomparable client experience from the first-time buyer to the seasoned seller. Visit them today in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, or navigate compass.com day or night.
Welcome back to Lunch Agenda. I'm Kiko. We're at the Line Hotel in D.C., and in our third episode on food admin, we're about to meet two bold food HR professionals, one who's rocking it in New York City for her own two restaurants, and one who's risen through the ranks at one of DC's most beloved restaurant groups over the past 9 years. So let me introduce them. In studio, I have Claire Parker. Welcome, Claire.
Thank you.
So Claire is the director of HR at Neighborhood Restaurant Group, or I'll call it NRG throughout this episode, having served as their director of special projects and director of private events prior to this current role. Before joining NRG, Claire worked with La Varenne Cooking School in Burgundy, France, and Los Angeles as the resident chef, cookbook researcher, and manager of culinary education. After undergrad at Cornell, Claire completed the professional culinary arts program at L'Académie de Cuisine and worked in the kitchens of Blue Duck Tavern in D.C. and La Madeleine, a Michelin-starred restaurant in France. On the phone, calling in from New York City, is Leah Campbell. Welcome, Leah.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining. So let me introduce Leah. Leah's a co-owner of Hearts and Servos restaurant in New York City. Did I say Servos right, Leah?
You did.
Okay, cool. Where she runs human resources and manages operations with her two partners. Leah has worked as an HR professional in the restaurant industry for the last 10 years, previously as director of HR and communication for Andrew Tarlow's businesses. She also worked with a national workers' rights advocacy group for the hospitality industry and has consulted on human resources for restaurant groups in New York. So let's start with some quick information about the restaurants that each of you support. Claire, can you brief our listeners about NRG, Neighborhood Restaurant Group?
Sure. Neighborhood Restaurant Group is turning 21 years old this summer, I guess. It started in 1997 with Evening Star Cafe, which is in the Delray neighborhood of Alexandria, Virginia, and has grown since then to total, 18 restaurants and 3 butcher shops in the area.
So across DC,
one in Maryland and in Virginia. We have a few there as well.
Great. And I found it interesting something you told me in conversation that while NRG has been around for 21 years, the HR function was never crystallized until 20 years into their existence.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of restaurant groups and independent restaurants probably find themselves in the same situation where the HR functions as they are covered by people within the organization. You know, in a single unit restaurant, that's probably the owner who's also the accountant and, you know, director of operations and every other position there is that's needed. So we have many of those functions covered still by the same people and departments that did over all those years. But last year, we put myself in this role to just focus more on culture and just being a little bit more proactive about all of those areas of focus.
That's exciting. And yeah. I heard Leah kind of chuckling on her end because you were referencing her as the owner who wears all those hats. Yeah. So Leah, I had the pleasure of eating at your restaurant Hearts down under the Franklin Ave train stop in Brooklyn a couple months ago. It was amazing. Congratulations on being named 5th best new restaurant in America. Can you just quickly tell the listeners about Hearts versus Servos? When did they open and what's the difference of the two concepts?
Oh yeah, of course. So my business partners and I, my husband Nick Perkins, who's the chef, and Miles Fallon, who runs the service side, opened Hearts in October 2016. It's a 30-seat restaurant in a little garage, a former garage in central Brooklyn, where we live, and then we actually opened a second restaurant this past year, close to where Niles lives, in downtown Manhattan on Canal Street. So there's a lot that's similar about them. Servos has more of a seafood focus, and particularly inspired by the Iberian Peninsula, whereas Hearts is a little bit more pan-Mediterranean. But those are the two spots.
Nice. So for a while, I considered pursuing a role in food HR. I just think it's a fascinating arena. And, you know, if you care about relationships between people, I think that it would really keep me challenged. And, you know, I truly believe it plays such a key role in food businesses. I wonder whether you, either of you, saw yourselves going down that route years before you were named an HR head, and even how it feels introducing yourself at a party and saying, I work in HR at a restaurant. You know, what? How does that identity feel for you?
Well, I'll jump in here. It still feels very new to me. I think that we approached filling this role and creating this role a little bit differently than maybe some other organizations have done, in that I don't have a formal HR background. You know, I originally come from the kitchen and other parts of the food world. So because we were lucky enough to have, you know, a strong accounting team and a general counsel and people kind of filling the nuts and bolts day in, day out, payroll, you know, all of those important things, we could think a little bit more creatively about the type of person who would, you know, do well in this role. And I wouldn't necessarily have dreamt it up myself, but as it turns out, it seems to have combined a lot of the things that I enjoyed doing and every one of the jobs that I've had with the group and prior to that. And it's a great role, really, for anyone who is curious about people, who likes interacting mm-hmm. with people, who, you know, tends to think they have good instincts about people, and likes to solve problems and, you know, kind of work in casual diplomacy. So for me, it's been a really nice fit, and I feel really lucky to have been given the opportunity.
And Leah, you know, to echo what Claire was saying, I kind of feel like there are two buckets of HR work. There's, you know, the quote hard stuff like payroll systems and tax mm-hmm. forms and insurance. And then there's more proactive, you know, work like staff training and reviews and building mm-hmm. company culture. Which do you spend more of your time on as an owner and HR director?
Oh, great question. I mean, I think it's really sort of dependent on the week. I try to balance both of those aspects. And then sometimes for me, of course, there's making granola or, you know, something else that comes in as well. But I think, you know, I started in an office of a restaurant group doing filing, and you know, the owner taught me payroll and then kind of handed it off to me, and then developed into the kind of forward-looking and deeper-reaching questions about workplace culture. I think it's a balance now, but I would say, you know, to your question about what's it like at a party when you introduce yourself from restaurant HR, I think a lot of people go, first of all, I didn't know that existed, and then then they immediately have questions about, you know, how do I negotiate a raise, or just their own HR questions. HR people in the wild are kind of like roving therapists.
You guys are like specialists now, like doctors, where you just can't get away from all of us. We want to know all the answers to our burning questions. Yeah, that makes sense. I love it. So, Leah, you wrote this article for Munchies, and the title was "We Can't Change the Restaurant Industry Without Improving HR." And in it, you open it by calling HR a relatively rare and unusual restaurant position. Why did you feel the need to write that article? How did that, you know, how did that make sense in all of the things that you have going to get your point of view out into the world that way?
My friend and editor of Munchies at the time, Helen Holliman, reached out to me about writing that. I jumped on it because, there had been a lot of talk in the news, but also just in general and in the industry about, sort of these titans of the industry coming under fire for years of harassment either in their own hands or in their workplaces and in the culture. Really wanted to think about not only how do we address a couple of bad apples, but is it really a question of bad apples, or is it a question about structural change that's bigger than the restaurant industry? I had done a little bit of work with Restaurant Opportunity Center, a national workers' rights advocacy organization for the hospitality industry, and worked on this project, the racial equity project. And I, in doing that, really, it opened my eyes to how important it is to address implicit bias as an issue structurally in our world that we bring into the workplace, If we're not thinking about that, then when people bring up issues or there are conflicts, we won't address the fact that they're responding to something that, we might all be contributing to unless we work with intention and thoughtfulness to try to turn it around.
Yeah. And I have found myself, speaking of Restaurant Opportunity Center, split between, you know, two movements that are playing out in D.C. right now, and I want to just quickly mm-hmm. ask you for a New York perspective mm-hmm. on, you know, the tension between Restaurant Opportunity Center's work to enable all food service workers to make a living wage with the ability of restaurant owners to sustain. Now that you're mm-hmm. the owner, but you've had this background of advocating with ROC, how is that playing out for you at your restaurant?
Well, I mean, in New York, our tip minimum wage is increasing. It's going to be up to, $10 at the start of next year in 2019. So we're in a very different position than potentially other places
the rest
in
the country
that have
okay.
a tip credit, our tip minimum wage. My perspective is that it's been really gratifying to see this issue from many different sides. I do think it's important to remember that there are different sectors in the industry, and something like a tip credit might affect people who work in those sectors very differently. Whereas in one sector you might have tip workers who are earning upwards of $20, $30, $40, $50 an hour, in other places it might be more like $8 once you factor in tips. And so it's important to create legislation that protects the majority of workers and not just a small minority. I think that, there are 7 states that have that don't have a tip minimum wage, where there's just one wage. They have a thriving restaurant industry there. So we're sort of seeing it play out, not all the way in New York. As I said, the tip minimum wage is going up to 10, whereas the minimum wage will be 15 in the city next year for large employers. So it's not fully all the way there, but we're doing it.
Right.
So as a small business owner, I can say we're making it work.
It's helpful to hear that perspective because I've felt torn on the issue. So beyond, that debate du jour of just this issue of tipping, let's talk about the hard, the hard work of payroll. You mm-hmm. said you do that weekly. How does payroll processing vary from restaurant to restaurant? You said that you learned it from Andrew Tarlow when you were supporting that group. How is it different in your own restaurant? Or I'd be interested in how it's different to do payroll at your restaurants versus like if you were doing it for a big chain of restaurants.
Well, I don't have experience with bigger chains, but what I can say is that one of the things that I really thought about in my time working in HR is, and Claire, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this too, from your perspective, that I used to think of, maybe you've got one HR person and their role is to do all of payroll. From my experience, it's actually really important to train management to be able to do payroll processing on a weekly basis for their own team. That means reviewing their hours, inputting tips into a tip sheet if you've got a tip pool, and checking that against, so that tips coming in, tips going out equal each other. Having somebody who understands what all those rules are is really important, but the more you can sort of deputize your leaders of the teams to be in charge of their own payroll processes, the better. They'll be able to check and make sure if someone missed a punch, they'll be able to catch it in real time throughout the week. So one of the biggest things that, whether you're a small business or for me, working with more like mid-sized, larger clients that I think about is, do you have the right team assembled to do payroll so that you're kind of working all along the week to get it right? And then also making it clear for your team members what's required in order for them to get paid at the end of the week. That's got to be their responsibility too. And there are better clock-in technologies. A lot of the POS systems now allow you to clock in and out through them, and they're more user friendly than they've ever been. And then payroll technology, so taking advantage of those too, so that you know, wherever possible, you're streamlining the process.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Claire, any differing perspective from
NRG? No, absolutely. I think having more than one set of eyes on payroll on a weekly basis is really important. So in our case, we have, you know, most of the work, I would say, falls to the general manager at each location, and they're the ones making sure that people clocked in and out at the right times and that the pay rates are correct. And, you know, sometimes they're employees who work two different position types, making sure they're clocked in as the right type and, you know, on the right day. And then we do have a location accountant assigned to a group of restaurants each. So there's a back and forth just to have a second set of eyes, making sure that everything's correct before it gets run through.
Smart, smart. So Claire, I'd like to talk to you a bit about staff benefits. I know, you know, something that you do is, you know, you handle recruiting and you talk with, you know, very experienced manager level people about why they should come to work with NRG. I have to say that after working in a few food businesses, the phenomenon of staff turnover and churn and burnout was just very present. So, you know, I would love to hear from you about what incentives actually get people to stay in a restaurant job, maybe what brings them in, but also, like, what do you think are the non-negotiable benefits that someone needs to have in a food job?
Sure. On benefits, I mean, everyone wants to be paid fairly, and, you know, within the DC restaurant community, there, I don't think there's too wide a range there, so we're kind of all competing for the same people at generally the same pay levels. In terms of recruiting, you know, it's become increasingly challenging over the last 5 years in DC. I wish I knew the statistic. The
How
number
many
of restaurants
have
here,
opened?
Yeah,
I wanted
and the number
to ask
of seats
you
when
that.
You break it down to that, it's just really astonishing. So it's great for a diner. It's a great time to be dining in DC, but it does mean that we're competing with each other for everything, you know, from both our diners to our staff. So, you know, technology is, you know, helping get job postings out to more people in a lot of ways. You know, there are many more sites and apps where you can post for jobs, and you know, people still walk in the door and ask for an application.
What are your favorite sites to post jobs? Where do you find your best people?
You know, it depends. For management level, there are some recruiters who we work with. We also use culinary agents and poached. Honestly, we still post on Craigslist quite a bit, and I know that that's the first place a lot of, you know, hourly employees look.
Poached is one that I didn't know about until about a year ago.
Yeah, there are a bunch out there now. But really, I mean, what works, I think, is pretty old-fashioned, and it's just someone either likes patronizing the establishment and they're looking for a job, so they, you know, seek to work there. Or really, we hire a lot of good people and they know a lot of good people. So we try to harness that and really motivate the people who are already working for us, who already believe in the programs that we're putting together, you know, to tell their friends about it. And we incentivize, you know, for management level with actual referral bonuses if they introduce us to someone who gets hired and lasts.
That's smart.
So, yeah.
Leah, anything you'd add there before I turn to a new topic?
I have one quick thing to add, which is I once read, I didn't come up with this idea, but I once read that the people around you are the best benefit at work. So if you come into work and you feel like the work you're doing together on a daily basis is building up rather than breaking down, the sort of shared sense of respect and trust and commitment that form the bedrock of feeling engaged in any kind of group, whether it's work or other parts of life, then, you know, that in some ways that's the kind of, I think, the biggest benefit you can offer people. And that starts with hiring.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about best practices and innovation in food HR. I'm curious to hear about models that you both, you know, look to. So when I was at Byright, I would say Zingerman's was a model for us as it pertained to staff training and service approach. What restaurants do you hold up as models?
Well, I can say, you know, in the DC market, I hear really wonderful things about Aaron Silverman's group, you know, Rosa Luxury and Pineapple and Pearls. People who work there really seem to love it. And, you know, touching on what Leah said, there are benefits and we're all kind of working from the same, you know, options there, you know, as far as health insurance and other fringe benefits, dining dollars and that sort of thing. But really, if you can proactively create and sustain a positive culture that people enjoy, and ultimately everyone wants to enjoy going to work and, you know, be able to do their job and thrive and then go home and feel great about it. So that's a local example that I hear really good things about.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of this market, we have a manager who moved here from San Francisco who has wonderful things to say about Natimius, which has Flower and Water and Salumery and a couple other places in San Francisco. And one thing that I really, took to heart from that is they have a lot of programs and educational opportunities that go beyond the walls of the restaurant, go beyond, you know, your working hours, and anything from a seminar on, you know, financial planning, to, you know, just kind of general life skills. And I think anything you can do to extend the community beyond the actual walls of the restaurant and just remind people that they have a family there, you know, that cares about their just their well-being and happiness as a human, I think is really good.
Yeah, yeah. What about you, Leah? Any other models that you aspire to emulate with your HR practices?
Yeah, I'm going to give props to, it's not a restaurant group in the traditional sense, but a food organization called Drive Change. Working here in New York, they have a food truck. What they do is they train young citizens returning from incarceration to work in the food industry. And they have a working food truck that those people will staff, and then also they place them in restaurants in New York, and then eventually those people can get jobs in those restaurants. So I find their way of looking really inspiring, and they're addressing some of the, you know, challenges that are, I think, top of mind for restaurateurs, not only in New York or D.C., but all over, which is hiring as the industry, like, grows. I think it's the second largest and fastest growing in the country.
What's the largest?
Good question. I don't know.
What tech growth? I don't know.
Yeah. But, you know, we have a pipeline issue. We can't
right.
find the candidates to fill the job.
Right. Yeah.
We also have a pay issue, I would argue. It's such a big industry, but consistently comes in at lowest paying jobs. And that may not be in the sectors that Claire and I work in. Again, the sections of the industry. But as we look at increasing pay, also looking at creating opportunity for people and having partners like Drive Change out in the world who are working to give people those tools and opportunities and then work with restaurants to kind of build a bridge. That really inspires us.
Yeah, thanks for putting Drive Change on our radar. I have been reading about training programs for formerly incarcerated neighbors being a great source in different markets across the city or across the country. And one model I've seen that inspires me that seems to buck the trend in terms of how they kind of position staff to work together is those restaurants who are kind of blurring the lines between front and back of house. So, you know, I a couple examples I've heard about are Westbourne in Manhattan, you know, Camilla Marcus's restaurant. I've heard her talk about that, where front of house shares, you know, where front of house literally switches with back of house every so often. And then there are, you know, the Dabney in DC, I've heard, does this a bit. Legendary restaurants like Chez Panisse and in Berkeley and the River Cafe in London do this. So I have a quick audio clip I want to play. I heard the founder of River Cafe in London talking about this with Ruth Reichel, the legendary food writer, at Cherry Bomb Jubilee last month. And I just thought it would be fun for the listeners to hear how they talk about this restaurant that's been open for decades on the banks of the River Thames in London, finding a way to kind of equalize roles and pay ultimately between front and back of house. So here they are in conversation. Ruth Rogers of River Cafe is the one with the British accent, and Ruth Reichel chimes in with her American accent.
Jobs. So waiters peel potatoes, kitchen porters prepare the fish, the chefs all do the butchery, and then we all cook together to get ready for lunch. The waiters don't cook, the waiters peel garlic, chop chilies, pick herbs. And then we all cook together, and at 12 o'clock the waiters go and change and make sure the tables are all set. The chefs all get onto their sections that change every day, and then we all cook for lunch service, and then we sort of have our lunch, and then we write the menu for dinner, and then we do it all again. So we just...
I'm just fascinated by this notion of waiters doing prep work, that you're all in it together. I mean, it's such a radical idea. compared to the way most American restaurants are run, where the kitchen does one thing and the front of the house does something completely different.
When I worked in kitchens where the chefs would cook, well, the chefs and waiters would not get on. Like previously, if you'd make food for the waiters that you just no one cared about, because you'd be like, it's just the waiters. And there was a kind of divide. But when I started the River Cafe, straight away you see that there's this, it's everyone. And I don't want to make it sound like it's some kind of, like, it's a serious workplace, but everyone gets on because we all sort of share the common goal and, you know, everyone's in it together.
So I'm curious whether that resonates with either of you, whether you've seen that in action, or if you want to offer another kind of unique approach to easing some of the challenges in a restaurant staff.
Well, I love the idea of that. I can't say that we do it quite to that level in any of our restaurants, but I will say part of the training for anyone in the front of house is to spend some time in the back of house so they gain an appreciation for, you know, what it feels like to be at the pass during a busy service. And just get a glimpse into what's difficult about that job. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that sounds great.
Lee, have you seen that?
I would agree. I would agree. I one of the things that both of our restaurants have, and we feel really passionately about, is our kitchens are on the same level as the dining room. Hearts is a little bit behind, like kind of behind the bar, but there's a window, and the service is just like totally open. And we talk a lot about what that does for our teams. And I think, at the end of the day, guests seem to love it too. So one of the things we try to think about is like structurally designing the restaurant. I think that's kind of the thing that I think of hearing these two women talk about this is if we're going to make changes like that, kind of what other pieces would need to change in order to make it possible, whether it's, kind of looking at how that would work inside the labor laws that we currently have, or the way the building is built, or, training time and hours. And I think it's really worthwhile to think about how we can evolve that.
Cool. So I have time for one more topic that I'd like to, tap your brains on, and that is the pressure that's probably come your way in the wake of the Me Too movement, and just the way that there's been a light shone on sexual harassment in the workplace, and in the restaurant industry. Claire, I know that you spoke on a roundtable discussion on this topic. What has NRG's response been to allegations in this industry broadly, and what are you doing differently now?
Sure. Well, I'm sure we all agree in saying it's about time. I mean, the intense focus that we've had collectively on this issue is overdue, and I think only good can come from all of our eyes and ears being on it. So I think last summer and fall, when some of the biggest news stories about misbehavior, to put it mildly, in the restaurant industry started bubbling up, we were pretty proactive about it. So we went and had kind of a talking tour at each restaurant with all the staff. We reissued our manual just to make sure that everyone understood, in case they'd forgotten, because we have some employees who've been around forever, what our policy is, what procedure we have in place if you ever feel, that you're in, a situation that makes you feel uncomfortable. And one thing that, we're lucky to be able to point back to is, two of our core values, I'd say. One of them is transparency, and the other is an open door policy. And we've always been very specific about making sure people know that, if they have a problem and they aren't getting an answer from their direct supervisor that satisfies them, they're encouraged to go around them and above them. We've become kind of
a jump the ladder.
Jump the ladder. Yeah. So we've become, a bigger company, but I think we've done a pretty good job of maintaining a family feel and, some elements of a startup. It's not hard to find, the email address and cell phone number of everyone from our ownership to, CFO to me, certainly. My cards are all over the place. And so I talk routinely with our managers about, that topic, and just make sure that it's fresh in their minds and, a rotating topic in pre-shift. Hopefully this is an indication that we were doing pretty well before that, but I haven't noticed really a change in, occurrences of
incidents.
Of incidents, yeah.
Right. Leah, what about you? What's the best type of sexual harassment training that you've seen, or what are you, how are you treating this issue in your two restaurants?
So I would agree that a huge part of this is making it clearer than you think you need to, about how open that door really is. And then the second piece, I think, is talking with your teams about, and again, I feel like a broken record, but about implicit bias. It's not about being necessarily a good or bad person. Structurally, in our world, gender and racial bias, I'll just pick those two, but of course there are others, exist. And unless we talk about them in our workplace culture and we create policies and practices that encourage us to mitigate those biases by slowing down thinking about it, and unless we sort of take it away from a point of, you know, when you think about harassment, it's often just defined as unwelcome conduct that creates a hostile work environment for someone. For example, someone makes an offensive remark or a comment or a joke, even if it wasn't intended to offend. If it was offensive, then that's what matters. But I think what's a little problematic about that is that it puts it on the person who's offended to define it, right? It says, are you okay with that, or did it offend you? Which is kind of another way of asking, like, can you tough it out, or can you not take it? And if we could look together at, instead of asking that kind of question, asking more often, what as a group, like as Claire is saying, you know, values that we've established, we've codified together, that isn't how we talk to each other here, then it's less about how one person feels in the moment or whether they can take it, and more about
group norms.
Everyone in the group protecting those norms.
Yeah, that makes sense. I heard one woman talk about, she's a line chef, she was a young line chef, talking about, well, what do I do if I've permitted a certain type of remark from other chefs in the kitchen for months, years? How do I now change what they think I will accept? And I know she was really wrestling with that. You know, are they going to take her seriously if she, you know, tries to have a different attitude about it now and does put her foot down? So those things must be hard.
Yeah, and again, you know, if you have the values in place, then, you know, in our situation, if we do receive a complaint about anything, you know, it's no longer the responsibility of, you know, the person making the complaint to say that bothers me, so now everyone has to change. We all have a shared role in policing the culture that we have in our workplaces and in our dining rooms. And, you know, it's not about them being a squeaky wheel. It's about, you know, thank you for telling us that we can correct this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we are at the point where I ask each of you for an action item that our listeners can take to change the food system in a way that you believe it needs to be changed. I'll let either of you kick us off. What's one small thing people can do in their day-to-day lives?
I'll go.
Something.
Yeah, please go ahead.
Go ahead, Leah.
Okay, cool. So my action item is about changing the way we change every day when we come into work or going about our lives. We're impacting change, whether or not we know it. And I think structural change anywhere benefits structural change in the industry. So if you're thinking about doing something differently, big or small, I would suggest that we all think about adding a step, which is to ask, can anyone else be at this table? Should anyone else be part of this conversation? I think that'll help us all do things in a way that is with people, not to them. We'll realize assumptions we've been making, and hopefully we'll make better decisions.
Very meta, Leah. Change the way we change. But yeah, I hear you loud and clear. What voices are represented in big conversations? Over to you, Claire.
Yeah, well, I just want a second, Leah. Mine's going to sound very practical after that. It's so easy to voice an opinion online these days via Yelp or TripAdvisor or any of these things. And I think that we need to get back to a place where, you know, to quote Danny Meyer, hospitality is a dialogue. And if we look at that very literally, to me, it says, you know, talk about your experience while you're in the experience. Most of us, all of us, I would argue, you know, we want you to leave the restaurant happy. We want you to enjoy what you're eating and appreciate the service that you're experiencing. So I just wish that you would let us know when we're doing a great job while you're still there. Let us know when we're not doing a great job so we can turn it around for you. And, you know, it allows us to learn. Hopefully it allows us to improve your day. And yeah, just
all feedback is useful feedback,
exactly.
And people don't give it enough.
Yep.
I mean, it boggles my mind how few people even let a restaurant know if they get food poisoning.
Right.
Oh my God, yeah.
Okay, so restaurants want to hear from you, diners. I really like that.
While
that's really
you're still
tangible.
In our chairs,
in person, in the moment where then the manager can, you know, understand, you know, more directly what happened. Yeah,
yeah.
So Claire and Leah, I'm grateful that you joined me today to help explore this career in food that I think a lot of the listeners hadn't wrapped their heads around as much. Lunch Agenda aims to elevate the value of food by highlighting people like you who, you know, don't get the same type of coverage in the news. And, you know, I hope by learning about some of the thinking behind how food businesses are run from a people perspective, we can all be more thoughtful about which restaurants and food makers we support with our dollars and with our time. So if you want to follow these two great HR professionals, you can do that online. Leah is at Hearts Brooklyn or Servos New York on Servos NYC on Instagram, and Claire's work can be followed along at NRG Restaurants on Twitter. Next week, we will cap off Lunch Agenda's food admin series with the often hidden role that I've played for the past 10 years, which is marketing and communications. I will have the founder of a nationally renowned restaurant PR company here alongside a director of brand for one of America's fastest growing fast casual chains. So I will talk to you next week. Thanks for joining.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.